Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record permanently archived at vnnforum.com. Today, we're going to resume with The Eradicator by Mike Smith, a 2024 novel published. You can find Mike Smith's Substack out there and check up on what he's writing. He also leaves comments at Kirksville Today. Today we're just going to do chapter 7. I've been having a little trouble with faulty wiring, so we'll just do one chapter instead of the usual two. And this is a little longer, about 13 pages, page 49 to 62. So let's get into it. Chapter 7 of The Eradicator by Mike Smith. Chapter 7, The Losers. Jake woke up. Remember, he had been attacked by an orangutan. The ceiling was gray. Jake woke up. The ceiling was gray. He tried moving his head, but only passed out again. The next time he woke up, two heavy women with faces that looked partly melted by fatigue and contempt stood over him. The women wore street clothes, but acted like medics, taking his pulse and changing an IV drip bottle that was somewhere back of him. He became aware of a thing in his mouth. He was choking. It was in his throat, too. He didn't know that it was a medical ventilator. He was trying to cough, but he couldn't. He might have panicked, but one of the women gave the vent a quarter turn, and the feeling of obstruction gave way. He fell asleep. He was coughing when he woke up next. His throat was as dry as paper, and the vent was absent. His face felt numb. He touched it and discovered that bandages covered it. He wondered where he was. He guessed he wasn't in a hospital. No hospital he ever saw looked this bad. He lay only 2 feet off the floor on one of many concrete slabs which jutted from the walls. 3-foot-tall concrete block dividers separated these slabs. Each divider bore a stenciled number. H-054 was the one beside him. He turned on his side because he felt his arm was now free of an IV drip needle. A strong smell of cleaning fluid filled the air, even though the floor was dirty. Another smell permeated the place, body odor from the men who lay on other slabs. He realized that he was in a homeless shelter. His other arm felt heavy. He looked and saw a plaster cast on it. Did he break his arm? How? Then he remembered the orangutan attack. He wondered when it occurred. It seemed only hours ago, but maybe it was as long as yesterday. A medic approached him and spoke in an even voice, some words about his injuries and the shelter's rules. He stared at her as if she were from another planet. His head was clear when another medic, a young man with a shriveled face and shaved head, brought the female medic back and they removed the cast. "How long was I out?" Jake asked, his voice raspy. 3 days, the young man answered. "Days?" "Don't talk," said the woman. "Dinner's in 15. Do you feel well enough to go to the commissary?" He stood, and the young man assisted him to a common bathroom. Jake pissed, catheter-free, and felt like a cadaver revivifying. The commissary was about the size of a 2-car garage and contained 5 tables. Apparently, the homeless had their meals in shifts. Today's meal was hot green beans and a cold slice of sandwich meat, washed down with a warm cola from a can. Jake looked at the people seated at the next table. Most were men, but shelters evidently were co-ed. He saw 2 women at a 3rd table. The men's looks and demeanor recalled to him photographs taken during the Second World War. The men, all in their 30s to 50s, looked like Allied soldiers during that war, beaten and hardened, with drawn Anglo faces and fierce, though halting, body language. Watching them gave him the feeling of being in the presence of his great-great-great-grandparents' generation. He wondered why he was here instead of in a hospital. The bald young medic explained to him that hospitals admitted great apes and their handlers first. Humans had to get health care wherever they could find it. In Jake's case, he wasn't rushed to an emergency room, but instead was brought to this shelter, which had admittedly minimal medical facilities and staff. Anyway, the medic finished his explanation without showing any expression on his shriveled face. You're a vagrant without ID, It's logical you ended up here. Jake spent the next 48 hours waiting for more information about his injuries and memorizing the rules. Learning the shelter's rules took only a minute. It was a year-round congregate shelter, and there were three rules. No fighting, rule one. Rule two, the injured and ill had priority over the healthy, meaning they could stay longer. Rule three, one must take seriously the employment notices on the bulletin board. Jake later learned that these notices were as disregarded as public service announcements because they were flat unrealistic for the majority of the homeless. His injuries entitled him to a stay of undetermined length. His arm healed, but his facial injuries were more serious. He was told that removing the bandages had to wait at least a week. His face itched often, and when he complained to a medic, he was told that the itch was a good sign because it meant the flesh was healing. Another medic had the opposite opinion. Both agreed on one thing, that his facial injuries had changed his appearance. They couldn't know how much as yet. As a scientist accustomed to working on interesting problems, he found life here challenging. The slab bed was comfortable enough. The other inmates, so to speak, behaved themselves. The meals were okay. But having nothing to do except eat and sleep and read moron magazines or watch TV was like torture to him. He told himself repeatedly that he should feel thankful for surviving the orangutan attack and for having a place to stay, and that if he didn't feel thankful, then he should force himself to feel it. He did this, and it helped him. He got interested in the other residents. At first, talking with them was no more edifying than watching TV. Then Little Ralph, a man who stood 5 feet 6 inches tall, told him, "I owned a trucking company that went tits up in the tweak." The tweak was the worldwide economic depression and the subsequent confiscation of much property. The confiscation saved the U.S. economy. Jake had heard of the tweak, but it had not affected him since he was among the groups exempted from the confiscations. Remember, he's a big-time scientist. These groups included not only essential persons, but the lowest proles who didn't have much to confiscate. Little Ralph looked like a prole with his patched beard and greasy, slick-back hair, but his story showed that he was no such thing. "My company shipped all over the country. We did $100,000 business a month. They say you gotta laugh or cry, right?" His chuckle was mirthless. Jake wanted to ask for more details, but didn't. Because the orangutan attack destroyed his ID, he had given a false name, Sloan, to the shelter, fearing discovery of his true identity. He chose to err on the side of reserve. Lucky was the nickname of the thin man with a strange, dignified way of speaking. He told Jake that he used to design factory robots. After Great Ape Integration, or GAI, wrecked computer chip production, robots could not be maintained. "Every firm with which I had an association brought its business to a close," Lucky said. He added almost under his breath, "There were 20. "That many businesses failed under you?" Jake asked him, astonished. Lucky didn't respond. Jake went on, "I don't mean to suggest that you're to blame. I blame the tweak." "It was the apes," Lucky said firmly, "and back of those culprits," he cut himself off. Everett was a computer programmer who ran out of computers to program. After that, he worked in retail, and after retail sold out, he slept rough. It's more of like an Australian term for sleeping outside, sleeping rough, they call it. A long scratch marred one of the lenses of his eyeglasses, and he didn't bathe as often as the others. "If I get some work and save enough money," he said humbly but fervently, "I'll be in position to get my ZPEP certification. A ZPEP will qualify me to troubleshoot chip manufacturer," ZPEP. "You mean computer chips?" Jake asked him. Everett vigorously nodded yes, but the look in his eyes was bad. Tall and husky, Steve kept to himself almost as much as Everett did, but was cordial enough when spoken to. "I worked as a software developer, a back-end engineer. I want to be a plumber now. I've heard people say that plumbing is a good business, Jake echoed. But only apes can be plumbers, and, Steve added with a grin that froze Jake's insides, I'm not an ape. Unaffected by the tweak personally, Jake was beginning to understand that it might not have saved the U.S. economy. He even suspected that it might have put a dent in it, which no one had bothered to make him aware of before. Remember, he's in a lab with his head down all day in the microscope and test tubes, not thinking about the bigger picture. These terrible times brought in by the powers that be are forcing people to think about the larger or the largest context. A gregarious older man named Comrade pointed out what to eat and what not to eat in what he called the mess, meaning the commissary. Jake had no idea what his story was, but guessed that he was probably a cruise ship cook before the tweak sent the cruise business under. He was surprised when he heard that Conrad had owned North America's last shipbuilding company. When a staff member affirmed that fact, Jake felt what he had when Steve had showed his anger. He was wary of Conrad. He wondered why a man of great business achievement had ended up here. Alcoholism? Drug abuse? Early onset dementia? He felt an even worse chill when a black-eyed, somber-looking man who kept straightening his excessively combed hair introduced himself as Johnny Clay. Jake didn't know many scientists outside genetics, but he knew Clay's name. Everybody used to. The top rocket scientist in the U.S. space program had held national celebrity status, but that was years ago, and lately the space program had fallen, a crack-up officially attributed to climate concerns and budget challenges. Clay, who aside from his frequent readjusting of his hair, had no egotistical mannerisms, told Jake that GAI, Great Ape Integration, ended the program, the space program that he used to run. Quote, we failed to develop adequate training courses, he said with a faint smile. Didn't you have savings, relatives, friends, connections? Jake asked, heedless of the possible rudeness of the question. Yes, no, no, and no, Clay addressed each item consecutively. Then he explained, the savings ran out after the connections did. As for friends and family, he tossed his head and shrugged. A soldier in the war for progress must sometimes make sacrifices. Jake thought, a soldier in the war for progress. That sounds like something I would say. Clay's predicament, Johnny Clay's predicament and his were similar. Yet when Clay asked him, since we're speaking so frankly, why are you here? Jake could only lie. Drugs. Clay stared at his eyes. You don't look like a tweaker. Jake wanted to say more, but again, he couldn't let anyone suspect who he was. The bandages disguised his physical identity. Although they would come off in a few days, according to the medics, and although he might lose his anonymity then, sticking to Sloan was all he could do. He wondered what his face would look like when the bandages were removed. He became unusually aware of other people's faces, what they looked like. Surprisingly, the faces of most of the residents here were well-proportioned, almost beautiful. They were not the shapeless, bohemian-type mugs he had become accustomed to outside the shelter. Then he thought of Greta Ondrakova, whose face was also good. He had made it his habit to stay in the commissary as long as possible, eating his meals slowly. He had become fascinated with finding the accomplished people here, the gems in the rough. He wanted to talk at least once with every resident and was succeeding in this aim, but he shunned the clearly screwed up. For example, there was a man with Tourette's syndrome who kept shouting, not hidden, not hidden, with all the nightmarish pain of trying to express and simultaneously suppress a powerful urge. Jake didn't have to avoid him for long, because one day the man no longer appeared in the commissary. The shelter ejected him. But soon Jake thought that Even the screwed up have a story to tell, so he decided to approach the most obvious one left, in case the shelter should eject him before he could speak with them. That was Joey, a short, wiry man about 30, who trembled like a chihuahua. Joey. His tattoos seemed to crawl on his arms. "I'm a vaccine survivor," he told Jake. He squinted in Jake's bandaged face. "Oh, you don't know what that is, see? When I started Sustain, I had a bad reaction. Not to the boosters, to the first shot. I didn't die, I just have problems."
"Sustain is safe and effective," Jake said.
"You believe that?"
Joey snorted. Jake thought about it. "I suppose that no vaccine is perfectly safe."
"Well, that's for damn sure," Joey said scornfully.
Jake noticed Joey's right hand. It appeared half-withered and scuttled back and forth on the table like an excited tarantula. Joey lowered his voice.
"The whole thing is about population control."
"You may be right."
"I know I'm right."
Joey's right hand continued to dart back and forth on the table, making this noise, rattle, 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 rattle.
"It's messing people up. It's killing families, and they make you take it every month. Or else."
Jake felt uneasy. He didn't like what Joey was saying. His uneasiness was fortified by the bigger fact that the residents here, despite the accomplishments which a number of them could boast of, were really losers. So he's struggling to overcome the middle-class mentality of anything that's not respectable is wrong. By that very fact, he's trying to come to grips with just how systemic the corruption. It's so easy to believe that something is simply biased or that it's a skin disease when it's actually bone cancer, is how I like to put it a lot of times. So he's depicting this guy starting to come to realization of just how big this thing is, how big and deep it is. Similar to my own when I realized with heart and stomach sinking, like, oh, reading The Ordeal of Civility, how deep the Jew problem actually was. So something akin to that is what's taking place in Jake. He's starting to realize, like, you can't write these people off as losers, but he's trying to do just that to preserve his conception of how the world works at this point. That's how I'm interpreting it. Jake felt uneasy. He didn't like what Joey was saying. And also, I think even depicted here, proles have an easier time understanding that, maybe, than people in the upper middle class or bourgeois or upper class people do, because they've always had a boss. They've always seen that, you know, you get what they give you, and you get screwed a lot of times, and they're not looking out for your best interest. So in a lot of ways, it's easier for them to accept the truth than it would be for an upper middle class think highly, as I like to style the bourgeois type. If you just do the right thing, then the right things will happen to you. Well, life doesn't really work that way a lot of the time. And that's very hard for that type to handle. And let alone you add to Joey being Jake being alone in the lab and then not really thinking about anything broader than his own work, right? But then his first life always shows you what you're missing eventually in time. Like it's designed that way. So you see, you do your work, and then it's misused by others, and then all of a sudden it turns into a giant problem, and you're out in the street, and now you're in a homeless place, and you're trying to account for all this and figure out what's actually going on. Joey felt uneasy. He didn't like what Joey was saying. It's messing people up, killing families, and they make you take it every month or else. His uneasiness was fortified by the bigger fact that the residents here, despite the accomplishments which a number of them could boast of, were really losers. Now, do those people he described sound like losers? No, they're objectively not losers in the sense that they had successful lives and now they wound up here. And many complained about their fate. They whined. Isn't whining a weak thing to do after all? Jake thought. Whiners aren't special. Don't they deserve to be in a place like this? Don't they deserve to be in a place like this? Well, he can't extend himself to them. Does he deserve to be there? No, of course not. They're no different from him, but he can't accept that yet. No, he decided. Little Ralph, Lucky, Everett, Steve, Conrad, Johnny Clay. No, these men didn't deserve to be here any more than he did. Okay, that's good thinking. Were all of us victims of a police state? He wondered. Or maybe it should be called a mismanaged state. A wailing cry interrupted his thoughts. Volunteers brought in an old woman whose head was covered in dried crimson blood as we turn on to 56. The only medic present today helped to throw her onto the shelter's one gurney. They rolled her past Jake to an empty slab bed. Seeing her gashed face, Jake unconsciously lifted his hand and touched his bandages. He got the story later. The police beat her up. Joey told him that the police rob poor people even now as part of the tweak. That made no sense, though. The tweak was supposed to bypass people who had no money. Besides, the tweak rescued the U.S. economy, officially, at least before GAI threw a monkey wrench in it. It took Johnny Clay to tell him the reason why the police had nearly murdered Candace, the old woman. He informed Jake that RJ was a long-standing federal government policy. RJ stood for Reparative Justice. The policy was an open war on old people, RJ, young people, and people whose families had money in the past, and more or less anyone who was disliked for any reason. Not just police, but anyone could commit physical violence against such random nobodies and count on official support or indifference. Candace was evidently a target of this state-sanctioned anarchy. When Clay began explaining the rationale behind RJ, which involved the notion that average people were heirs to unjust historical privilege and therefore deserved whatever beatings and killings they got, Jake felt disgusted and waved him away. Johnny Clay told him that Congress was considering boosting the penalties for resisting RJ. Don't whine as they beat and kill you. That in itself is criminal. Jake felt disgusted because he hadn't realized until now the extent of the havoc wreaked on ordinary people, on non-essential persons. He's always been an essential guy in the lab. These were people who grew the food, who made sure the plumbing worked, the builders, small and great. Unlike scientists and other, quote, unquote, essential persons who lived more or less in a bubble, these humble people received no exemptions and struggled under a reign of abuse. The day came when the medics removed his bandages. Symmetrical, he thought when he saw a scarred face in the mirror. Not bad. He had a different face and felt like a different man. Paragraph break. New scene. Chad. Remember our Iran war vet, or maybe Afghan, I think Iran vet, blown up, missing arm, missing leg. Killed two cops in L.A. and moved into a hotel with an Asian manager who's also betraying him like his friend did last time we saw him. Chad looked for news about his crimes, killing the two cops, by watching the crusty TV in his motel room. The picture was bad. He saw nothing about himself, but watched into the night. He had never watched much TV, always too poor to afford it. TV set. The closed circuit set on the base in the war only played uninformative junk, so what he saw now shocked him. First the commercials. Orangutans in t-shirts and jeans laughing, for a hooting kind of laughter dominated the soundtracks, while sipping espresso at granite kitchen countertops. Adult bonobos playing catch with juvenile bonobos in spacious green backyards. Those two commercials advertised home mortgages offered by Industrial and Commercial Bank. Apparently, viewers were expected to believe that apes could own houses, that apes did own them. Why don't you own? Asked a young woman at the end of one of these ads. Another commercial advertised, quote, the future. It specified no product or service. It featured inspirational vistas of mountaintops and of silhouetted apes doing victory dances on a beach. Bonobos, chimpanzees, gorillas, orangutans. Mostly it lingered on extreme close-ups of their faces. Various tones of hickory. Their eyes blinked into the camera lens. Victorious music swelled under a girl's voice, whispering, "We believe. We believe in the struggle. The future grows." Commercials came end on end for so long that Chad counted them. There were 10, 20, 30 in a row. End on end should not be hyphenated there, just parenthetically. The most repeated one involved ape-human romance. A scrawny pompadour nerd saw his smiling girlfriend kidnapped by a gorilla and did nothing, since the girl apparently enjoyed the kidnapping. In a satin-swathed luxury apartment, which apparently belonged to the gorilla, she had sex with the animal, moaning and groaning while it merely grunted. Over this scene came a voiceover. Science says it's possible. Justice says it's right. The final shot displayed the logo of an ad firm called The Love Foundation, and a familiar-sounding adenoidal girl said in a voiceover, "Just fucking love already!" Every commercial involved apes in some way. In one, a bonobo police officer handcuffed a jaywalking man. In another, a chimpanzee skateboarded across an office desk, sending papers and reports whirling as black-suited executives cheered it on. A graying gorilla had some sort of emotional moment with its handler on a park bench amid misty autumn trees. An orangutan teacher in a classroom, packed with other orangutans who sucked air through their pursed lips, corrected a human child at a math problem. Next, the shows. Proper shows, dramas, sitcoms, documentaries eventually appeared on some networks. All featured hardcore pornography. Chad was familiar with such porn because of decades of easy access to it for everyone. It bored him for the same reason. But these shows were so aggressive that even he searched his mind for the name of a regulatory agency. Responsible Media Agency, he guessed. Where was it? He didn't know why, but during some of the nonstop orgies, a voiceover whispered, "The future grows." And not as a double entendre. Not porn, the children's cartoons depicted human-ape friendship. The cartoons always showed humans in full figure and apes in extreme close-ups. In one cartoon, human children and various types of apes communed by telepathy. The cameras kept cutting away to a little girl whose eyes were moony when she looked at her male gorilla pal. Great apes dominated news reports. One report interviewed a man named Rappaport, typical Jew name, who promoted a concert series that was part of an arts festival started by him and the publisher of the local newspaper. Instead of booking the concerts in an auditorium or a public park, they had insisted on the streets of an affluent residential neighborhood. Every performance denounced anti-ape prejudice. In a short clip, a famous country and western bass, Zach Mishkin, sang part of his number one hit single, "Be Kinder." "Them old bigots ain't gonna win, we gonna kick their ass again." The noise of the concert shattered a few windows, but the gorillas and orangutans who attended, along with their handlers, broke many more, almost wrecking the neighborhood. The report presented the concert series positively anyway. The station and the newspaper were partners. Rappaport vowed to bring, quote, "even bigger acts to the neighborhood in the future." No resident was interviewed. The slaying of a 14-year-old orangutan got much news coverage. "The crime of the century," ran all the chyrons. A mob had hanged the orangutan. The mob, made up of two young men, committed this murder under the cover of an Arkansas night. "This unprecedented tragedy, a work of absolute evil, shocks the conscience of every kind person and moves us to say, death to all humanist scum," the pundits and politicians stated. The emotional denunciations and moralistic jeremiads almost completely obscured the facts. Only by gathering many pieces of information from many sources could one put together a picture of what had actually happened. As Chad learned by scanning the internet, that picture did not support the emotion. The mob of two hanged the orangutan because it terrorized the mother of one of them, including pulling off her dress and feeling her up. TV reports omitted that orangutans had assaulted and even injured people there for months. But all that made no difference because all such people were, quote, "scum" anyway, and apes were sacrosanct, according to moral experts. One such expert, Dr. Berg, said that the state must summarily hang the young men as an example to all humanists. Another, Dr. Stein, said that the case demonstrated the fascist nature of the human psyche. A third, Dr. Hendricks, stated that the area's water service and electricity ought to be cut off immediately and no resident permitted to leave, and that kind organizations must redouble their efforts to bring great apes there. "We haven't done enough," he insisted. Chad watched the reporting of another case's conclusion. An orangutan mangled 8-year-old Rory Fisher, a federal official's son, last year. Fisher Père, French for father, Fisher's father demanded no blood, but working-class people had taken an unexpected interest in the case, circulating petitions, raising money, and organizing public demonstrations. The authorities stopped all that almost overnight. Nevertheless, grassroots, quote, "justice for little Rory" activism led to a trial of the gorilla's handler at last. The trial dragged on for months. During this period, Fisher Pear issued his only public statement. "We should feel grateful to live in a moral community that welcomes beautiful, God-created great apes." And like Tibbetts' father up in Iowa, "and yes, we do love your wonderful tacos." The court issued an odd verdict. Insufficient oversight. Remember, this is the handler, which carried a sentence of time served plus 2 months probation. Then the grassroots activist exposed the judge as a drunkard. He had stayed fried during the entire trial. Authorities quickly removed him. The case got a do-over. This time, the verdict was not guilty. The handler not only got off, but got $1 million damages paid by the city. The city, in turn, sued the grassroots activist for defamation and won civil damages of $10 billion. "The system worked," concluded the reporting. "The case is closed." On another TV station, Chad watched a documentary about a new savior, a sort of American Jesus. This universally acclaimed preacher was a somewhat oversized bonobo. Its interpreter, in a reversal of roles, spoke as it waved its paws. The substance of its sermons was simple, namely, evil ruled humans' hearts and only theirs. Preacher did, "so the humans are evil, humans only theirs." Why? Because humans had done all the evil in history. The nasally narrator pointed this out, that this argument had impeccable logic behind it. Less pointed out, the preacher's handler tied its bow tie, booked its appearances, and wrote its sermons, like the ones operating MLK. I think he's alluding to Levison, Jew Levison. Going by the name Ben Levy, he got a half-second soundbite in the half-hour documentary. "The future grows," he said. The sermons were usually given prior to marches, which took place in the streets of residential neighborhoods. In Galveston, Texas, and Jacksonville, Florida, the great teacher, who always wore an inconspicuous leash held by Levy, first denounced, quote, "persistent inequality," then led fellow apes and their handlers on a righteous raid. Marching in lockstep, the handlers sang gospel hymns while the apes shit the streets, stoned windows, assaulted passers-by, and growled, shrieked, or made other, quote, "joyful noises," in the narrator's words. Remember, make a joyful noise unto the Lord. It's a Christian thing. The great teacher had a moniker, Reverend. Reverend not only signaled for Earth's deliverance from humanity and loped at the head of suburban crusades, but, as the narrator declared, represented, quote, "the conscience of the universe." So this is the ape MLK. And the civil rights crowd, so-called, really did act like he's saying. They acted like complete monkeys. At the end of the sermon, sometimes Reverend ceased merely waving its paws and joined in with the making of joyful noises, screaming while jumping up and down. Quote, "everyone listens to Reverend because he speaks the truth to power," concluded the documentary. In the final scene, "he speaks truth to power." That's an old leftist refrain. In the final scene, thousands of marchers chanted a Sunday school song. Crazy. The world's gone crazy, Chad thought. other people have to feel the same way about this. Where are they? The consolation was that no news on the TV set mentioned him. It was only apes, 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 day and night. That made him wary for a different reason. He suspected that all of society, or as much of it as he could access, was an echo chamber. He felt surer of this suspicion after seeing a commercial for an all-chimpanzee TV show, which billed it as, quote, America's number one hit, a week before its scheduled premiere. So everything's scripted. The internet didn't mention him either. Remember, he killed two cops. He read many online stories, but they only expanded on the TV reporting. Violence committed by apes always got blamed on humanists. A racist. The world must strive for inclusion. People must give way to kindness. A video clip on one site reported that kind activists took direct action last night against a humanist who had ranted against a low-trust society. That phrase, low-trust society, was currently considered insurrectionary. Remember the Harvard academic who wrote the book Bowling Alone that proves that wherever they force diversity, it just makes people hunker down indoors where they feel safe. It doesn't make them mix and celebrate and work together. And kumbaya is not the reality. Bowling Alone is the reality. That phrase, low-trust society, was currently considered insurrectionary. He died in the hospital from his wounds. So the kindness activist attacked a evil humanist who didn't like and was speaking against the low-trust society. The distrust was his, explained one of the activists. People who refuse to trust must be destroyed. No tolerance for the intolerant. Another website reported disappearances of an incalculable number of people that were being vanished. The Desaparecidos in Argentina decades ago, remember? Government agents snatched some in broad daylight, resisting futilely. Others simply were never seen again. All had in common one thing. They had said something against apes. Some had opposed GAI loudly. Others had made only a single suspicious comment. An accountant had objected to the smell of a chimpanzee in his office. Gone. A young man wondered how orangutans could fly planes and asked his uncle about it. His uncle, a retired pilot, reported him. Gone. A woman refused to perform a sex act on a gorilla. Gone. Her refusal was called uncooperativeness, as well as humanism. Chad concluded that the web was also a part of the echo chamber. Podcaster Ira promoted his guest, podcaster Ben, who promoted his own guest, podcaster Tubin, who in turn promoted podcaster Ruben, who promoted Ira. An echo chamber? Shit, this was a circle jerk. He fell asleep in a gloomy mood. When he woke up, it was noon, and he switched the TV back on. He watched until evening again. He noticed that a female newsreader that he had liked watching last night was gone. Hell, he thought. She got replaced like Greta's billboard. Where did she go? On vacation? He didn't think so. No one referenced her absence at all. Then he thought, she was disappeared. Did they take her for refusing to have sex with apes? No proof of that, he thought. He turned off the TV and thought about Greta. He decided that he must protect her. He didn't know how, not yet. He only knew he had to do something. And that's where Chapter 7 ends. Chapter 7, Losers. So both of our heroes are getting immersed. They're getting immersive in this new world and who's behind it. And everything that's particular and peculiar about it does not seem very good. Not very helpful, very useful, very wise, or very much in the interest of normal white people that these two represent. So Chapter 7 finishes up on page 62. I've been Alex Linder reading to you out of Mike Smith's new 2024 novel, The Eradicator. Check out his Substack. And as always, everything we do is permanently archived, the Learning College, in the audio section of vnnforum.com. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again for more from The Eradicator by Mike Smith real soon.